Good morning and welcome to this June 24th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. I'll give you more information on that later in the show. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and oh, what an hour it is. It's an hour of a huge treat for me. We're doing something somewhat rare for us, at least Too rare for us. We are exploring children's literature, and I'm joined by two fantastic guests. It's my pleasure to welcome the wonderful William Joyce and Dan Santent, who just won the prestigious Caldecott Award, to the show this morning. William is with me now. Dan will join for the second half of the show. William Joyce is an Academy Award winner, a Grammy Award winner, and his illustrations have appeared in numerous New Yorker covers. Among others, he created the conceptual characters for Disney Pixar's feature film Toy Story and A Bug's Life. His last picture book, Numberlies, was based on the short film that was named Best Animated Short at the Cleveland International Film Festival and Kids Audience Choice Award for Best Short Film at the Toronto International Film Festival. William has won three Emmys for his animated TV shows, Roly Poly Oly and George Shrinks. His big screen projects include Robots, Rise of the Guardians, and Meet the Robinsons. But it is in his latest picture book come memoir, readers get a rare look inside the brilliant mind of William Joyce. Billy's Booger includes a reproduction of the real book that William made as a child, which kicked off his career as one of the most beloved writers and illustrators in children's books. There's obviously so much more to say, but I'm going to stop there. William, Billy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
I'm so glad. Now, what is it? You haven't stressed the word booger very much.
Oh, well, I will.
No.
Oh, that's to come. That's to come.
Okay.
So let's talk about it. For those who haven't yet picked up the book, it's such a great book. And actually, I have it also on my Kindle where you can zoom in. You know, if you touch your screen, it'll zoom in on all of the illustrations, which I thought was kind of a cool feature. But take us kind of into the world of Billy's Booger Nose and talk about where the book came from, a little bit about it, and then we'll kind of dive in from there.
We'll pick and choose.
We'll pick and choose, exactly.
Sorry. Make up a book with that title, you just have to go with some of the puns. Well, the full title is actually Billy's Booger, A Memoir, Sorta. And it says, the truth of it is, and it says it on the cover, that it was written by myself and my younger self. And when I started publishing books, gosh, it's been a while, almost 30 years ago, one of the first questions I was asked repeatedly at either schools or in interviews was, well, what was your first book? And the truth was, and I've been talking about this for since the beginning of my career, that the first book I wrote was in the fourth grade for a contest to see what kid could write the best kid's book. And the name of my book was Billy's Booger. And it was not a memoir of me especially, but it was a fictional memoir. The teacher told us before we started, write about what you know. And so in that age-old, you know, chestnut of advice on what to write about, you know, and so I took it to heart, or something. I wrote about what I knew I wanted, or what I wished. And I wished that I was better at math than I was. And I wished that I had superpowers that came to me by some kind of fantastic event. And so when I wrote Billy's Booger, I wrote about a kid named Billy who was bad at math, and then he gets hit in the head by a meteorite, and then he gets superpowers, but also his boogers get superpowers, and they go out and they fight crime, and they get to wear capes, and they have bacon ray vision where they can change things like Brussels sprouts that taste crummy into things that taste like bacon. And they basically save the world over and over again. And I did it all in green pen on manila paper. And I thought it was good, you know, but it did not win the contest. In fact, I got sent to the principal's office as sort of a, this has gone too far, you know, kind of thing. I mean, I've been drawing pictures of, like, dinosaurs eating my classmates and dinosaurs eating my teachers, but they felt like this had gone just a little further than they wanted things to go. And so I was down and out. But the librarian took me aside a few days later and said, you know, she put all the books that had been entered in the contest into the library. They had their own, you know, library card or Dewey Decimal System thing. And she said, Bill, don't feel so bad. Your book is checked out, you know, the most. And people really like it. You know, older kids, sixth graders are checking it out. And so I felt redeemed and, you know, and in a peculiar way, like empowered suddenly. I had written a story that I had liked and felt really great about, and that, but I had upset some of the authority figures, but then my peers had embraced it. And it was in a library, you know, it was being checked out. It was a real thing. And that was a pretty vivid sensation to have as a fourth grader, to feel that sense of accomplishment and tragedy and acceptance all at the same time. And it never left me. And I've been telling this story all these years, and I wanted to put it in a book because it seemed compelling, and it seemed like a good way to say, you're writing, you're finding your voice as a kid, and sometimes that voice should be heard, or don't give up, you know, if it's not at first appreciated, if you're having a hard time. And so I completely, you know, set this thing in this 1960s, mid-60s sort of Mad Men looking era that I grew up in, with picket fences and radio flyer wagons and Schwinn bicycles and beehive haired, you know, ladies and necktied dads, and then did a facsimile of the book itself that I'd done in the fourth grade. That is exact as I could get it. All I have is a Xerox of the original, and that it was missing for a long, long time. I really didn't know what happened to it after I'd left grade school, but when I first started getting published, I started being asked, what was your first book? And I was like, well, it's Billy's Booger. And so in trying to answer, you know, try to find the origins, I went back to my high school and asked for my school records, the ones I always sort of taunt you with, you know, or say, this is going to go on your permanent record kind of thing. And they do. They have them for a period of time after you graduate from high school. You know, your school records are there. And so I thought it would be this vast, you know, sort of catalog of my daily, you know, development as a kid. And it was, in fact, 4 sheets of paper in a folder. And in one of those 4 sheets, you know, where they have this place for the teacher to describe your year and you, you know, there's room for 3 sentences or so. And my fourth grade teacher used only 2 words, and they're very specific. She said, odd child. And stapled next to that, as if, you know, exhibit A for her prosecution, was the book, Billy's Booger, in its ragtag manila paper, you know, worn out glory. And so we were reunited.
Don't you want to go back and find it?
I reproduced it as well as I could in this new book. So you hear in Billy's Booger, a memoir, you read and see my sort of setup to writing it, and then the book itself is in the center, printed out, I'm proud to say, on manila paper, and it is exact to the same color of green felt tip pen as I originally did it, and drawn as crummily as I could, you know, in my fourth grade stylings with bad spelling and everything.
Right.
And then I think the rest of the book is the sort of aftermath that I just described. So it's I found myself having to think back or look back on a sort of fourth grade level of taste and sophistication, and it was surprisingly easy to access.
Well, you kind of live in that world anyway with the rest of the work that you do. I imagine that you have, you know, one hemisphere of your brain in the kid world and one hemisphere of your brain in the adult world. And you, I assume that that's always a project that you have to marry those two things anyway.
Well, you know, I guess so. I always just think of them as a book. And occasionally I kind of go, well, a kid will like this or a kid won't understand this. But most of the time I'm trying to not talk down to them at all. And I'm just trying to make a good story that grown-ups and kids will enjoy. And so, and then, you know, it's like, and I have to do grown-up stuff every day, like pay taxes and things, which that really requires not the, the thought processes of a fourth grader.
Requires math, which I know you hate.
I won't even let them, you know, yeah. Like, I just don't want to know. Just let me go draw something, okay?
There's
let
so
me go
many.
Make up a story.
There's so many great lessons in this story. One of which is what matters to writers. And you know, if you don't win the awards, but if you reach one reader out there who says, "I connected to this. I think this is cool. I checked this out." Sometimes that's enough for writers, which I feel like is a good, I don't know, encouraging writerly story for people when, you know, when maybe fame, success, the New York Times isn't reviewing you, but one, you know, sixth grade kid out there says, "That was great." I think that's a, that's enough to push a lot of writers along, probably.
Well, it's the, for many of us, it's all we get. Yeah. And but it sure makes my day, you know. I mean, if I go to a signing or if I'm at lunch somewhere, you know, here in my hometown in Louisiana, some little kid comes up to me and says, "We really like your books, Mr. Joyce." I mean, it's like, thank you. And you know, they're sort of like bashful and all that. And I'm like, and the parents will come up and say, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry." I'm like, "No, man, it made my day. It was awesome." And oh, they, we read this like every night, and we like it too. I'm like, "Okay, you guys have made my day. Thank you." It doesn't get old, and you know, yeah. So, I mean, writers toil away in obscurity and by themselves. I mean, I have other careers where I get to go out and work with and collaborate with other people, and that's really fun too. And even on these books, I mean, you know, I do these now at my company called Moonbutt Studios, and you know, I ask around to everybody. I'm like, "Okay, does this seem too slow? Is this point getting made?" I mean, it's a fun way to work, but you do still feel isolated, and you do need sometimes that little pat on the back from somebody that says, "I understand," and then you feel like, "Well, okay, I'm not alone in this."
Right. Right. Well, I will tell you that I put our interview, an announcement up on Facebook, and people went nuts. People are so...
Oh, my
so
gosh, when, that's great.
The mere,
in what way?
No, the mere presence of your name makes people, like, giddy and happy and, you know, I don't know.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was drawing on people's memories. Yeah, it was drawing... It clearly was touching some, you know, happy memory nerve for a lot of people that say, just the look of his name makes me happy. So that's...
Oh, that's...
What
a, oh, my...
What else can you have, right?
I will.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about a lot of writers is that, especially children's writers, there's that age in childhood where everything feels more visceral, maybe because you don't quite have the language to describe what's happening to you yet, but time feels funny and stuff feels... I don't know, it just seems like a very visceral time of life and almost like a dreamscape time of life.
Yeah.
That seems like it lends itself better to picture books to kind of get at these emotions that kids don't have the language for yet. And I know you had said that this book was sort of a way of working out your fears at the time and working out your stuff. I don't really know what my question here is, but it does feel like childhood creates this great space for creativity that... I don't know if it gets pounded out of you as an adult or if it just gets morphed into, you know, more language-based than visual-based. But I don't know. This just seems like such a rich environment to work in for that sort of amorphous, hard-to-describe emotions kids have or they can't describe them.
Well, I think that you're stating something and you're inquiring.
Right.
You don't know the words yet either.
Exactly. Thank you. That's all right. That's why I'm
and
looking
that's
to
okay,
you.
Okay, because I know what you're talking about, and it's and that's a lot of what this book is about. It's sort of like you are living in a state of vividness, and so much is new, and you're trying to figure out how things work. And the rules tend to change, you know. Specifics aren't quite what grown-ups say they are sometimes. And so you're having to figure everything out. And so you go through life, and I was this creative kid. I mean, I was, like, relentless in the pursuit of idea and imaginings and stories, and it sometimes got on my teacher's nerves. And, you know, I think now they would probably give me Ritalin or something, which would be a catastrophe. And I think we do sort of underappreciate that aspect of our inner lives from back then, and that the reason story is so strong and pertinent to us then is because it's helping us figure out the world. You know, we're going through a fictional version of a character's journey, but the things that happen in that story ring true to us because they're familiar to our situation, or they're what we wish would happen if we were in the same position, that we would be that smarter, that brave. But it gives us a sense of how the world works, and gives you a sense of what you may try to do if you were ever in that kind of situation. And to not encourage that thinking is a crime, I think. And we don't mean to drum it out of kids, but a lot of times we do drum it out of kids, and we're stunted a little bit. And I was lucky enough that there were people that came along, teachers, librarians, my parents, that stood up for that for me, you know? And this book is kind of about that. I mean, my parents were very indulgent. You know, I get sent home with a note in the book, you know, says, your boy's been acting very odd of late. And my parents respond with, oh, you should see what he does at home. And, you know, the teacher obviously is frustrated with me, but the librarian is trying to find a way to focus me. And even the principal, you know, I've used every square inch of this book to sort of, you know, as part of the narrative. On the back of the dust jacket of the book is as close as I could reproduce the look of an inter-office memo from 1966 at a school, and down to the purple mimeograph, you know, printed, you know, page of the principal saying, can we please try to find some assignment that might focus this kid's imagination towards something worth, that won't drive his teachers and myself completely insane. Suggestions welcome at earliest convenience. Yours, Principal Blisterbone. I mean, you know, it's like, and my principal is the same way. Sort of like, this kid's got talent, but what are we trying to run a school, you know?
right.
And so here came, you know, this contest, and here came Billy's Booger, and here came the librarian, you know, trying to help me out.
I just have to pull one thing out for our listeners so they can sort of get a visual of this. But you have this great math paper where you're doing addition, and you turn all of the numbers, like the number 2 is turned into this scary dragon that you know, you draw the dragon around the number. And the brilliant thing about it, so many brilliant things, is that is how it feels. Math is scary, especially when you're first trying to represent, you know, abstract concepts in the age of 9 into, you know, numbers. That is how it feels. And so you gave such wonderful visual depiction of the emotion of how it feels to be on the inside of a kid's brain saying, this is intimidating, it's scary, I don't understand it, it's coming after me, you know, all of those things. I don't know, it took me back to that terrible time of uncertainty. It was really, that's really great.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was, and this is almost verbatim from some of my math homework from that period of time, where I was like, you know, to me, the numbers all had shapes and that implied personalities, right? And so I just would imagine them being these guys. And so, you know, an 8 would seem naturally to be a nice little snowman, pleasing shapes. And a 7, man, he's like this dinosaur with these teeth, you know, and 5s are these some crazy little, like, cannibals or something. I don't know. They got spears and stuff. And 4s were sailboats, and the 4 was the sail. And I was just trying to make it have a narrative that was a little more appealing to me, and also, I guess, was echoing my anxieties and my joys at the same time. The teacher, however, just wanted to know that, you know, 8 minus 1 was 7, all right?
right. And, yeah, and it's too bad you can't teach William Joyce's brain to anybody, because that would be a treat if somehow you could translate that to...
One of the guys at Pixar, Joe Ramp, used to say, and this is one of the nicest things anybody's ever said to me, and it echoes what you just said, and though I don't think it will really work, but it is a nice, for me, it was a nice thing to hear. He said, yeah, you know, I think people should go to William Joyce School for a while and then come work for Pixar.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yes. Now that we know about your boogers, we need to learn about your brain. That's what Billy's brain will be part 2.
Well, they dwell close together. That was part of my thematic point.
Right.
You know, boogers are up there close to the brain, so they have access to knowledge maybe that Billy, you know, the holder of the brain, doesn't actually have.
Exactly. The other thing I like that you do for a children's book style, or, you know, for cartoon, the kind of sort of the imagined world, is that you draw a lot of things from real life. I heard this great story of you being paid by your sister to feed her grapes while she was on the phone with her boyfriend.
This is true.
I love that story. And all of these things sort of organically make their way into your work.
Well, there she's in this book, you know, repeatedly. You see her in her curlers and always on the phone. and you glimpse my other sister a little bit, who's a little older. But I didn't have room to get the grape thing in there. It's so funny you brought that up. But, you know, in every illustration in this book, she is on the phone, which she was a teenager at the time, and she was always on the phone. And, you know, that was like when you only had one phone in the house, right? And it had the long cord, usually in the kitchen. And so then there's a picture where she has, you know, it's like I tried to get all the hairdos right, like my mom's beehives, you know, not quite as high as hers actually was because it wouldn't fit in all the pictures. But my sister's curlers, if you look in here, you know, you remember this? I don't know if you're old enough.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
She had these curlers. They always had these curlers in their hair. And they tried to get them bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, I remember my sister resorting to beer cans.
Right, yep.
She would wrap her hair around in a beer can. And I was like, well, I can't put a Bud can in this children's book, you know, on top of my sister's head. So that's the one thing I had to kind of, you know, pull the punch a little bit on.
Yeah, I remember all the soup can days. Yeah, I think that's what makes everything so appealing.
I'm from Louisiana,
so
it was a beer can.
So it was a beer can, right. Yeah, it's fun for the adults to read because, you know, we have our own little trip down nostalgia lane. And
sure.
Obviously very visually appealing to the kids.
Well, I mean, I wanted to set this in that time. So, you know, it starts out with once upon a time when TV was in black and white, and there were only 3 channels, and when kids didn't have play dates, they just roamed free in the out-of-doors. There lived a kid named Billy. And I would tell that exact sentence to my own kids when they were little, and it, to them it was like I was talking about, you know, medieval England, you know?
Right. I know. We're all lamenting the bygone days that are, yeah, that you can't send your kids outside in the front yard anymore. It's
Well, you can.
You can, right.
It's like, I was reading this about the new free-range children movement.
Right, right.
Which I agree with. And somebody did, you know, the statistics on how long you could leave your child in the front yard unattended, for how long it would take for your child for it to be kidnapped.
Right.
And statistically speaking, yeah. All right? And would you venture a guess here on the air what that number turned out to be?
Well, it's, you know, I'm sure probably 8 years or something, or never. I don't know, probably never.
It was 750,000 years.
Oh, my God. Oh, God. Wow, okay.
I mean, a number of generations would come and go before statistically your child would probably be kidnapped. So
now that my kid is a teenager, I've tried that trick, and it really, you're right, it doesn't work. I put her out there for weeks. She's still out there.
And everything's fine.
Everything's fine.
Yeah, I am nostalgic for that.
I know. Well, we're drawing down on our time, but given that it's a show mostly for writers, and I know I have a wonderful friend who's a kidlit writer who has all of his kidlit writing friends listening today, advice for advice for these folks who are trying to make their way in this world.
Oh my goodness, advice. You know, sure, keep it simple. And you can deal with very complex emotions and situations and in a simple manner. And it's the simpler you can try to get your complex idea to play out, the better you'll be off, I think. And it's the hardest thing to do, keeping things seemingly simple.
That is the hardest thing to do, yeah.
And that's the thing I've worked hardest at my entire life, and the thing when I was just getting started, and I was helped out by Murray Sendak, and it's the thing he always stressed with me, like, you're trying to do too much. And, you know, just try to keep it simpler, and you'll be amazed at how complex you'll be able to get with a simple idea. And then, outside of just the specifics of how to craft your story, and as I say, keep it simple. It's a tough time, and in some ways, it's always been a tough time to get published and to meet success and find success. But if you feel really strongly about what it is you're trying to say, then keep at it, and people will notice. And it took me, I think, 5 years and over 150 rejection slips before my first book was accepted. It took me, 10 or 12 years before I got to work on my first movie. And actually, you know, I got a film degree. And that's one thing. There are two things I wanted to do, make books and make movies. But both things came along, I think, at the right time. I mean, luck is a big part of anyone's journey and career. And there are a lot of times when I felt like I had run out of luck and things weren't going to happen. But then, right, oftentimes at that point when I was becoming most discouraged is when things would, by happenstance or something, fall together. So just try not to get discouraged and try to be open to self-criticism. That's also the hardest thing, is know when you're wrong. Know when you haven't gotten it just right yet. And a partner is a great thing to have in that. I mean, I've read everything to my wife over the years, and she's incredibly astute at knowing when it's not right, and even more astute at breaking the news to me in a way that doesn't make me, you know, go bananas. So it's if she's just a little quiet, then I know, oh, God, you know, this is terrible. She never says, I think it's too long and you should worry about the humor aspects in Joker 7. I mean, she never gets specific. And she'll just say, I think it's really good. And if it goes, that voice goes up too high, then you're like, uh-oh.
The benefits of being married a long time. You can tell these things from you can read her code. That's great.
Yeah. So, you know, because it's a lonely thing writing these, and it's good to be able to have somebody you can rely upon to help you on that journey.
Yeah. Well, you have so many fans out there, and you've touched so many lives, you know, from kids to adults, and from adults remembering when they read the books when they were younger. You've made such a positive mark on so many people. So what else can you do in life than that, right?
Thank you so much. You have made my day.
Well, I'll send you that little Facebook quote, because that'll really make your day.
Please do. I'm gonna bask in the warmth of that for quite some time. Thank you so much.
William Joyce, this was such a huge treat. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, anytime. I'm glad to come back.
Thank you. That was William Joyce. The book is Billy's Boogers. It's a great little memoir. The book he first wrote in fourth grade, sort of looking back on that time. Illustrations are fantastic. the great William Joyce. What a treat that was. You can find him online all over the place if you want to learn more about him. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Dan Santat will join me for the second half hour of the show. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming guests, all kinds of things. We are on Stitcher. We are on Twitter. We are on Facebook. There are no end of the places you can find us. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Dan Santat is the author, illustrator of Sidekicks, and the winner of the silver medal from the Society of Illustrators for Oh No, or How My Science Project Destroyed the World by Mac Barnett. He is also the creator of the Disney animated hit The Replacements. His latest creation, The Adventures of Beagle, The Unimaginary Friend, is the winner of this year's Randolph Caldecott Medal. Dan lives in Pasadena with his wife, two kids, and lots of pets. And it is my huge, huge pleasure to welcome him on this morning. Dan, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for coming on. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm getting all packed up, ready to leave for San Francisco tomorrow, and you know, making sure that the shirts are ironed and everything, and the ties are not creased or anything. And I realize I really stink at ironing.
Well, you don't have to iron your own ties when you win the Caldecott. That's my opinion. You
can, oh gosh, you I just you know what? I just throw away ties and I go, I have to buy new ties.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're done.
Right. What am I going to do with all these ties?
Well, that is fantastic news. You have to tell us a little bit about the Caldecott, sort of how people are chosen. We'll just open with that, sort of give us the rundown on how the book got entered, what they're looking for, and all the excitement around winning the award.
Well, gosh, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the judging process for the Caldecott Medal is shrouded in mystery. As far as I know, there's 15 elected committee members.
Okay.
And I think, to my understanding, they meet two or three times a year, and throughout the year they're just watching and reading every book that's out there, and then they get together periodically to have the discussions of, oh well, what did you think was worthy of making this list? And I believe, and you know, and of course my knowledge is fuzzy, but I think I'm like 80% correct when I say this. So what happens is that I believe that they all get together for one final judging, and to my understanding, I think they all pick their top seven books, and so from that they have to rank one, two, and three, and then they have to, I guess there's some kind of point system of some sort.
Okay.
And then, you know, I believe, like, whatever comes in first has to, like, clearly has to stand apart from two, three, and four, or whatever. And then that's how they determine the winner. But, you know, for years I've looked at the Caldecott Medal books, and, you know, in terms of what they look for, for those who don't know, the Caldecott Medal is awarded for distinguished, you know, art in a picture book.
I should have said that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, that's fine. You know, every year there's always it's different every year. So year to year, you'll have different committees. They reelect the committee members every year. And every year, you know, all the judges all have, you know, certain tastes. And this year, just, you know, my number came up.
This year, they had the best taste. That's the
well, yes, obviously, yeah. And they I'm speechless here when I think about it, because you never. It's not something you ever hope to achieve. You never say, you know, I hope one day I can
you know, what should I say? It's my goal to one day win the Caldecott Medal. You can never say that.
Right.
You know, it's one of my friends who was a well-known author. He said that the best thing you can do is to do a book that's good enough to get into that top seven. Like that's the best you can do. But then outside of that, you're going to be in a position where it's completely out of your hands, and these judges have to basically debate it out. And you know, you have, you know, you end up with an honor, maybe. You end up with the medal, perhaps. And that's something that I was struggling with in the beginning, because this year, you know, as the medal winner, and then there were six honors books. You know, honestly, for me, I think it's debatable. I think any of those honor books could have easily have also won the Caldecott Medal. But, you know, the debate went my way.
Yeah, so great. Well, let's talk about the book. Let's talk about Adventures of Beagle. Because this is one of the first, I mean, in addition to winning the medal, this is one of the first books that you wrote on your own. I know you've done illustrations for other people, but this is one of the first couple of books that you've ever written. So, right.
It's an idea that I've had in my head for about, I want to say, like 8 or 9 years. But I'm always so busy illustrating other people's books that I never take the time to work on my own. And, you know, generally when I have a schedule, I'm really quick to set my own projects aside to meet a deadline for another project. And you know, I guess that's one of my flaws, is that I'm always busy, you know, so willing to drop my own projects and work on other things. You know, like right now I have a graphic novel that I'm working with another publisher, and I had a graphic novel that I'd done previously, Sidekicks, and that took 7 years to do. But it didn't, you know, if I had just focused all my time on it, it wouldn't have taken 7 years. It probably would have taken 2 years if I just focused all my time on it.
Yeah.
And then I told myself, you know what? I don't want to be in that position ever again. I don't want to wait another 7 years to do another graphic novel. And, you know, here I am again. I mean, honestly, almost another 7 years are going to pass. And here I am still working on this graphic novel because I have my hands in other projects. You know, I guess that's the nature of the business, or that's just, you know, the way I work. I don't know.
It's funny because I talk to so many writers of novels, and that seems to be the pace of novel writing as well, as 5 to 7 years.
Oh, yeah, right.
So, you know, maybe that's just what it takes to write a book, no matter the book, right?
Right. With the current work that I have, it's like with the upcoming graphic novel, I mean, I'm already done with the script. All I have to do is storyboard it out and do the final art. And I've been in that holding pattern of that step for about a year and a half, almost 2 years now. Just, I'll get to it when I'm done with this big mountain of work, you know?
Yeah, and the drawings, obviously, at least in The Adventures of Beagle, clearly the book is all about the drawings. It's, I mean, the text is wonderful as well, but really the drawings are exceptional.
Right, thank you. Yeah, with picture books, they're always telling you that, you know, the pictures have to tell as much of the story as the text does. And I work in a process where I'll write a draft of the story, and I'll just write it out, you know, plainly, like the character got on a boat, the character left the island, the character sailed for, you know, many days and nights and ended up in the city. But then I look at that text and I see the parts that I can illustrate, and then I modify the text so that it doesn't have to be redundant. So in other words, I'm not drawing a picture of him sailing off of an island and then also saying, oh, he sailed off an island, because then you're just insulting the audience. You know, you're calling them stupid if you're being redundant, you know?
Right.
And so you take the opportunity to use the illustrations to narrate the story, and then I like to use the text to sprinkle a little extra on top of it. So in the book, you have a picture of the character leaving the island on a boat, And rather than saying he got on a boat and left the island, you know, you use something else that says he did the unimaginable. Mm-hmm. You know, you're making another statement on top of the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Right. Some of that struck me. I was reminded a little bit of Where the Wild Things Are in the reverse, you know, that the actual
right.
boy gets on the boat to go out into the wild, and this imaginary friend gets on the boat to go to the real world, which was, and I wonder how many of these, you know, plays and homages and other writers are sort of in your head and informing your work, if it happens organically, or if they're really a conscious tip of your hat to the writers that may have inspired you growing up.
It was a conscious decision to reflect on Where the Wild Things Are. When I look at Where the Wild Things Are, I mean, there's such a beauty in the pacing and the narrative of the story, where, you know, it starts with a small panel that doesn't fill the page, and then his imagination grows and grows, and then the entire spread is filled with the forest. Hmm. And that's his imagination growing, and then he goes off on a journey, and then there are things that end up being a coincidence. So for the book, a lot of the imaginary friends are representative of a child's interests, and I didn't want to make the imaginary friends really generic. Like, I didn't want them to all be furry monsters with stripes and spots and horns and, you know, and big bulky bear-like things. You know, I wanted them all to have these unique characteristics where if you looked at the imaginary friend, then you could automatically conclude what the child's interests were. So, for example, there's in the end papers, there's a picture of a boy who likes to fly a kite. Hmm. And so his best friend is a cloud that blows the wind. There's a little girl in a swimsuit with floaties on, and her best friend is a fish. You know, there's a little boy that likes to play guitar, and his best friend is a little monster that hides inside a drum, and he drums, you know, he plays the beat. So they're the equal half to a whole.
Right.
And with the main character, Beakle, and I should mention that Beakle was my son's very first word for bicycle. And so when we heard him say Beakle, my wife thought, that's would be a great name for a character someday. And so I kept that in the back of my mind. But with the creation of the character, I wanted him to be the expression of creativity. And originally he was designed as a blank sheet of paper. Like, he was just going to be mm-hmm. this blank sheet of paper. But the problem was that I felt that gave away his purpose too mm-hmm. soon. Like, mm-hmm. they would just look at it and say, he's a blank sheet of paper. He's going to be, you know, something artistic, something, you know, a story of some sort.
Right.
And so I had to flesh him out, and, you know, I gave him some math, and he ended up as a white blob, you know, just this obscure, big white blob. And I remember there was a lot of rumblings online where they were just like, well, this character looks like an adipose from Doctor Who, and I'd never watched Doctor Who. I tried watching Doctor Who on Netflix, and I got as far as the episode where they go way into the future, and they see the last human being in the universe or something, and they're just like stretched out on a, like, she just looks like a big sheet of skin or something like that.
Right.
I remember watching the show, I was like, this is so, like, weird. And I remember eating a bowl of cereal while I was watching it, and I was like, my food tastes funny. Like, I don't like to watch this anymore. But it was very, like, in terms of time travel, like, in terms of a time travel show, it was very clever, so I might have to revisit it. But I remember looking online. I'm just going way off topic. So I went online, and I Googled adipose, and it just said, oh, yeah, it was supposed to be this being made out of fat cells. And I'm like, what? What's going on here? And, you know, some people are just like, why would he take the design of an adipose? And I thought, yeah, why would anybody assume that I just took an adipose And I just said, you know what? This would be a perfect character for a book. And then the crown, the paper crown that the character wears, it was I saw a photo of my son in my library of photos, and there was a picture of him wearing a yellow Burger King hat, and I remember it was on a road trip, and we were at a rest stop, and I remember he wore this Burger King hat, and he was so happy, and he just wore it for the rest of the trip, and it was just kind of him going on this journey with us to go see the grandparents, and so I figured, you know, I'm using that photo for the dedication. I think it would be nice to use the crown on the character, and my editor and I were also having this discussion about the personality of Beagle. Originally, we thought, well, maybe he's going to be a character that's really confident, like he knows he's special, and he is just waiting for the day to be imagined, but the letdown is that he never does get imagined. He makes this paper crown for himself, you know, saying, oh, I'm special, I'm great. And then it never happens, and then that's the real downer of the whole thing. Mm. And then, you know, it takes on a whole other meaning where you're thinking, I remember the editor and I were having this discussion of, well, would this little girl imagine this imaginary friend with a crown already, and wouldn't the crown be special? Like, wouldn't it be a real crown? And so, you know, that's when I started putting the little two pieces of tape on the back of his head.
I love the two pieces of tape. I was just going to bring that up, that the crown has these
right,
two little
right.
pieces of tape. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
And I remember talking to someone who spoke to someone in the committee, and, you know, the rumblings were that was it. That was the thing that was the tipping point for you. Like, they love the crown. They love the two pieces of tape on the back of the head, because it raised that very question of, is the crown something that the imaginary friend made for himself, or is the paper crown something that the girl imagined for him, you know?
Exactly, right. Right.
And ultimately, as the story took form, we looked at it as kind of like a self-made security blanket for someone who was insecure.
Hmm. That's great.
You know, it was this thing that helped him feel special because he hadn't found anybody yet. And I just recently got a tattoo of it on my arm because I just loved. You know, what the crown symbolized,
yeah.
You know, and I thought it was, I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, when I think about doing it, I didn't think of it anything beyond that. But I love the fact that it resonated with people so much.
Before we run out of time, because we're drawing down on our time, but I want you to tell the lovely story of sort of the inspiration of the book and the birth of your son. You know, you can make us all cry now. Go ahead.
Okay. So the story really is a love letter for my son. When my wife told me that she was pregnant, you know, as a parent to be, you immediately have these thoughts of, who is this person going to be? You know, what is this person going to be like? What is their personality going to be like? And you know, the months that you're waiting for this child to be born, you know, you have all these ideas in your head, and you're just wondering. But there comes a point, you know, the beginning of everything is panic. The beginning of realizing that you're going to be a soon-to-be parent, panic sets in. Like, you think, am I going to be able to do this? Will I be a good parent? And I think when you ask yourself that question, when you ask yourself, will I be a good parent? That's the moment when you realize that you're not just thinking about yourself. You know, right. Initially, when you find out that you're going to be a parent, the first thing is, I have a lot of things I need to do before this kid is born. You know, I need to go to Europe. I've never been to Europe. Right. And then you finally turn it around and you say, okay, am I going to be good at this? And that's, you know, that's when you take it upon yourself to take that step to bridge that gap and make sure that you're prepared for that moment.
Right.
And so basically, really, Beagle was just this emotional journey of how I went from someone who was not prepared or didn't think that they were going to be very suitable as anybody's parent to the point where you actually have the birth of this child, you know? There's a lot, you know, there's just a lot of, there's a lot of anxiety that goes along in the story, you know. Beagle is born on this imaginary, this island of imaginary friends. And in the story, you know, all these imaginary friends wait for the day to be imagined by a child. And so the stars pluck them out of the sky when they're imagined, and then the star takes them to the child where they get their name. Like, none of these imaginary friends know their name until they meet the child. And so in the opening scene, you see him, he's being born in a cloud and a rainbow, and the whole scene looks kind of like a delivery room. It looks like, you know, a celebration of family gathering together to you know, have this celebration of this birth. And as the story goes on, you know, no one imagines him, and he's left alone on this island. And, you know, he takes it upon himself to build this boat, and he goes on this journey. And, you know, the imaginary world is really colorful. And he builds a boat, and he sets off, and he ends up in this. He ends up sailing to the real world, and the real world's really drab and monotone. This reflects the lack of imagination. And he gets to this place, and there are things that are just foreign to him. You know, seeing people sleep on a subway. You know, just kind of not just going through the daily, you know, routine of life. And it isn't until he gets to a playground where he sees kids having fun that he can relate to everything. And, you know, that reflects my son's first day of school. Mm. It's the anxiety that he has of going to school and meeting people. And I think every kid has it on the first day of school, just trying to see if they can fit in. And I remember my son on the first day of school, he said to me, how do I know that I'm going to meet someone that I can get along with? And I said, you know, you just have to find one person. Hmm. You just have to start with one. You have to find someone that you have something in common with, and then everything will fall into place. Hmm. And when you go to the playground and you see kids, they want to play with other kids, but they don't really know the whole routine of introduction or, you know, small talk, if you will.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a spread where Beagle finally meets the little girl and they're having, you know, this interaction with one another. And it's really awkward. You know, the girl thinks maybe we should hug, and he thinks maybe we should shake hands. And then they switch the roles. He's like, oh, she wants to hug, so I should hug. And then she thinks, oh, well, I should shake his hand. And then they have this awkward moment, but then they embrace that awkward moment. And that awkwardness is what bridges that gap. And so they finally evolve into this moment where she introduces herself. She says her name is Alice, and then the character doesn't know his name. And, you know, she tells him, she says, your name is Beagle. And that's the moment in the story where that's me holding my son for the first time.
Mm.
You know?
Right.
You don't really introduce yourself. It doesn't really become a reality until you actually hold that kid in your hand. I've been speaking to a lot of friends recently. I have a lot of friends who are planning to have kids, and, you know, there's always that terrifying moment of, oh, should we start having a family? Because no one ever says, hey, you know what? I'm so excited. Let's start this family right now. I can't wait.
Right.
You know, everything's always
very,
like,
very
we need
scary.
To make sure that our finances are in order. We need to make sure that, like, everything is taken care of before we take this huge step.
Right.
And I equate the metaphor to being on a high dive at a pool. You know,
ain't that true?
You're at the top of the dive, and you look down, and it's just terrifying. You're just terrified, and you take the jump, you jump, and you're falling down, and you know, you're diving into the water, and the whole time you're going down, you're terrified. And then it isn't until the moment that you hit the water and then you come to the surface where, like, suddenly the terror just immediately disappears. Hmm. And you're just filled with just this rush of emotion, like, I am alive. This is I live. This is the greatest moment ever, you know? That's the metaphor I give to everybody about the birth of a child.
That is so true. And you so know? Great. Yeah, right. I could talk to you forever, but we're running out of time.
Oh, we're out of time.
I'm so sad.
Okay.
I know.
I'm sorry. I was just running my mouth.
No, it's fantastic. I could listen to this for hours and hours, so it's killing me to say we've run out of time. But you were a fantastic, fantastic pleasure, and I wish you a hearty congratulations on
thank you very much. Thank
very
you.
Well-deserved success. And I'm a huge, new huge fan of your work. I'm going to keep watching for you and wait for another, I guess, 7 years to bring you back on the show and talk about the next one.
Well, I have a picture book coming out in April called Are We There Yet?
Oh, good. Good, good, good. Yeah. Okay, so we can continue the conversation. That'll be great.
Correct, yeah.
Dan Santet, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Dan Santet. His book is The Adventures of Beagle, An Unimaginary Friend. It is out. It is available. It is the winner of this year's Randolph Caldecott Award medal. And that is all the time we have for today. I will not be back here with you next week. I think Nicole will be back here with you next week. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up with a little reggae for setting your morning off. I will sign off and see you next week. Thanks so much for joining me.